This time on Poll Hub, religions have been a part of human history from the beginning of humanity. But something historic seems to be underway as younger people around the world are either changing where and how they observe their faith or dropping religion altogether. What's behind this worldwide shift? We're discussing this with Dr. Phil Zuckerman, professor of secular studies and sociology at Pitzer College. And for our fun fact, we're also heading way back in time. Well, maybe not that far back. 1949 is the year, and the topic is driver's licenses. Intrigued? You know Lee has a story about this one, so stick around. And hi, everybody. Welcome to Poll Hub. I'm J.D. Dapper.
I'm Barbara Carvalho.
I'm Mary Griffith.
I'm Hunter Petro.
And I'm Lee Murray.
One of the things that when we look at polling and data, there's always interesting topics that come out of this beyond just the politics that everybody, you know, sees in polls. And there's been some international surveys recently that have shown something really interesting. Surveys are showing an increasing number of people who aren't practicing the faith that they were raised in. It's not always the case that they're becoming less religious, although that has happened in some countries. It's much more that people are more faith flexible than prior generations. In the U.S., for instance, Christianity is losing 6 followers for every 1 it gains. And in Italy, the ratio was 28-1. So a lot of this is based on great Pew Research from March of 2025. They reported after talking to 80,000 people in 36 countries all over the world, and they found that a fifth or more of all adults in this group, 80,000 people, 36 countries, have left the religious group in which they were raised. So real quick, what is religious switching? Religious switching is the movement of people away from or into different religious groups than the ones in which they were raised. And according to that report, Christianity and Buddhism have experienced especially large losses from religious switching, while rising numbers of adults are saying they have no religious affiliation.
Geography seems to have a major impact on religious switching. In India, Israel, Nigeria, and Thailand, 95% or more of adults report that they still belong to the religious group in which they were raised. However, 50% of adults in South Korea, 40% in Spain, 38% in Canada, and 28% in the United States no longer identify with the religion they were raised in. All of this is still according to those March 2025 Pew Research reports. And then when we zoom in on the generational divide, it certainly seems to be a factor in numerous nations. In 13 countries, including nearly all Latin American nations surveyed, as well as several countries in Europe and North America, adults under 35 are more likely than those aged 50 and older to have changed their religion. The reason given by the highest percentage of religiously unaffiliated Americans for leaving their faith tradition is that they simply stopped believing in their religion's teachings. 67% said that, according to a March 2024 PRRI survey.
So let's bring in somebody who knows a lot more about this than you and I do, Hunter. Dr. Phil Zuckerman is a professor of secular studies and sociology at Pitzer College in Claremont, California. He's also the co-author of a book, Beyond Doubt, The Secularization of Society. Dr. Zuckerman, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So what is your take on this kind of faith flexibility among people all over the world?
We got to separate these things out so I can address the kind of how do we explain people that are leaving their religion of birth and not adopting a new one? We could call those religious leavers or apostates or departers or people who become secular. And then there's the question of people who switch to a different religion from what they were raised in. And those are going to be different dynamics at play. I mean, so the underlying premise, though, I would say for the first one is when people are just leaving their religion, I think what's happening is the internet, let's just start there with both of these. The internet is going to be a big factor here. And it works like this. And actually, the internet, I know I just distinguished these two phenomena, but I think the internet actually explains both. I'm going to use the work of Peter Berger. He was a wonderful social theorist. He died recently, but he wrote a lot about, in the 60s, he wrote a book called The Sacred Canopy. And it didn't have any data, but the theory was rock solid. And our data has since sort of supported the main premise. And that is, he talked about, you know, with religion, if you're closed off, if you live in a society, and most of us did for most of human history, where there's kind of one dominant religion, sometimes there's not even a dominant religion, it's just the one religion. Like, imagine, I always used to imagine like an island off the coast of Portugal or Spain or Greece. Let's take, you know, that in this Greek island, it's just Greek Orthodox Church. Like that's it. There's no minority faith. There's no other church. There's no synagogue. There's no Muslims.
Right. Or no choice.
This Catholic island off the coast of Portugal, it's just the Catholic Church. And most humans for most of recent history have lived in, you lived in a rural area in England, or you lived in a rural area of Mongolia, there tended to be one religion. You may have heard of other religions, but they certainly weren't your neighbors. They weren't your classmates. You weren't playing soccer with them, and they weren't part of the government. You know, so most of us lived in this kind of, there was one single sacred canopy that we lived within. And what Berger argued is that as humans started to move towards cities, and as populations got more and more dense in urban areas, we started to rub elbows against other sacred canopies, and those canopies started to mess with each other, and you couldn't pitch your tent so neatly, and another tent was interrupting your tent. And basically what he argued was that this multiplicity of different religions causes a crisis of credibility for all of them. In other words, if you only know one religion and you're told this is the one true faith, and everybody else you know shares that, it's very plausible, it makes sense, it creates a kind of bubble. But once you start to really interact and get to know people from different religions, it causes you to think, well, wait a minute, is mine the one true religion? And they think theirs is the one true religion? And that pluralism of worldviews and that plurality of religiosity can crumble one's own surety in one's own faith, in one's own community being the only one. And so two things are going to happen in that situation. One is this crisis of credibility may cause people to just say, wait a minute, you know, I actually don't believe any of this stuff. Now, in the old days before the internet, if you didn't believe, you were alone in that. If you walked home from your little church in Alabama and everybody was speaking in tongues and you're like, I'm not really feeling it. I don't know what's going on.
You're alone in your thoughts, right?
You're alone in your thoughts. Yeah. And there's nothing you can do about it except hope that you feel the spirit in your belly next time. And eventually, you know, with all your uncles and aunts and cousins and colleagues, and you know, you're going to fake it till you make it if you have to. Now you walk home and you go right on the internet and you can quickly say, hey, I'm not feeling it. Anybody else out there not feeling it? And you are immediately connected with other people your age, with, you know, that, and you start talking, and that creates its own plausibility structures. It creates its own network of, oh, I'm not alone. I have social support. So the internet not only makes it easier to not believe, but it also exposes you to other religions. So some people, when there's diversity of faiths, shop around. So you meet someone, hey, they seem cool. They invite you to their mosque. I like it. My wife literally a couple years ago was like, I want to meditate. And she just went online and typed in like good places to meditate. And up came all these Buddhist places within a 15-mile radius. We checked out the websites. Ooh, I've heard good things about Zen. That's a cool website. Let's go check it out. And off we went to the Zen Buddhist monastery. And next thing we know, we're going once a week and meditating. And it's like, and they would say, how'd you come here? We went on the internet, right? Now that just simply wouldn't have happened. You know, we shopped around just like you would shop around for shoes or a car. So the internet, I think, is doing two things. It's allowing people who are having doubts and question their beliefs find immediate support in that. And it thus becomes easier to declare yourself a non-believer. And you have a social network to fall back on, and you have resources to draw from. Or it also facilitates shopping around. So I think this diversity of more and more people living together in more and more places. I've lived in Denmark for a couple of years. And again, Denmark was a classic case of everybody was ethnically Danish and everybody was Lutheran. And that was it for most of Danish history. Well, since Harald Bluetooth.
You're right, yeah.
And then suddenly in the last, 50 years, many immigrants from Muslim nations, many immigrants from Southeast Asia. So you have a more diverse culture. People are getting to know each other. Your boyfriend is suddenly Muslim. Your girlfriend is suddenly from this background. So you have more options. The internet even facilitates it even more. So, you know, now I'm hearing from people. My granddaughter is converted to Islam. And right away I say, well, why? Well, her boyfriend, you know, got her into it, but she really wants more spirituality. I get it, you know. So I think the globalization, the more societies become diverse, the more societies are online, both of those things are going to cause more people to abandon religion or shop around for other religions. Now, there's always I'm almost done. Sorry for the rant. But, you know, the countries you mentioned that you don't see this as much.
Yeah, I was interested about that because one is a theocracy. Israel is virtually a theocracy, right? So
almost. I mean, it's getting there. But what I would argue is we've often talked about religion serving multiple needs. So for some people, religion is about a spiritual connection. For some people, it's about community. For some people, it's about ritual. I mean, but one need that religion seems to serve is it helps in what we call cultural defense. So when a certain people feels that they're being threatened by another people, if there's different religions at play, it strengthens the religious identity. Mm-hmm. Think of Irish people under the yoke of Protestant English oppression. So Israelis see themselves, even though they're the ones currently perpetuating a genocide right now, they have always seen themselves as backed against a corner, threatened by all these Muslims and Arabs around them. So their Judaism is going to become even more stronger as an identity, as a cultural defense. I think you'll see the same thing in India, where you have this long-running history between Hindus and Muslims. And, you know, for many centuries, the Hindus felt persecuted by the Muslims. Now the Hindus are doing the persecuting. But I think when religion is linked to ethnic identity, national identity, it tends to be stronger than when that decreases. Israel used to be very, very secular for a while, but of course that now they're becoming rabidly fundamentalist in the wake of their violent conflicts with their neighbors.
You mentioned the spiritual word a couple of times, and something that Pew Research found, they asked the difference between religious and spiritual, and they found that 43% of U.S. adults had become more spiritual in their lifetimes, while only 28% claimed to have become more religious. How do you distinguish between spiritual and religious, and how do you think people around the world are doing so?
Can't speak for, you know, people in Vietnam or Laos, or I mean, I just, you know, don't have the knowledge there. But what I can say is, at least in a Western context, religion has had a bit of a branding problem as of late. You know, atheism used to have the branding problem when we had these atheist dictators, these communist atheist dictators like Stalin and Pol Pot and Mao. Atheism had a branding problem, and for good reason. Like, there were some really bad atheist regimes out there. But that has faded in a lot of people's minds with the collapse of the Soviet Union. You know, many people, communism just isn't what it was for our parents' generation or my parents' generation. My students in college don't associate communism with atheism. That's kind of faded from their mind. So what I think has happened is, with the rise of the religious right, with the rise of extreme conservative Fox News Christian nationalists, religion, even the religious, have realized this. So even my local fundamentalist church says, you know, we don't offer religion, we offer a relationship. Meaning, like, religion's become in many people's minds associated with institutions, top-down dogma, seminaries that are cloistered. Like, it started to have this bad. So spiritual seems to have a more inviting, warm feel to it. If you say you're religious, you're going to constantly have to say, but not like, you know, but I don't support what the Catholic Church did with its, you know, pedophiles. And I don't support what, you know, I'm not a right-wing Trump supporter, Christian Nash. I'm not that a Pam Bondi Christian. I'm not a, you know, you have to kind of, but when you say you're spiritual, it speaks of seeking. It speaks of openness. It speaks of the soul. It speaks of having a connection beyond just cold, hard carbon and the material reality. It's idiosyncratic, it's personal. So I think a lot more people are comfortable saying, I would like to have some spirituality in my life, which signals I'm tired of the materialism, I'm tired of the competition, I'm tired of the, you know, I don't want my whole life to revolve around my iPhone, I don't want my whole life to revolve around the internet. I want something more, something deeper. The thing about it is, the debate we're having is that spiritual identity a replacing religion, or is it kind of a watered down version? In other words, when people say they're no longer religious but spiritual, is it kind of like it's a change but not a loss? Or is it actually a change and also a little bit of a watering down, a little bit of dilution? They're not institutionally affiliated, and that is a big deal. They don't have well-defined concepts or beliefs that they're operating by. So it might be a kind of watered down, fuzzy, liminal version of religion that is actually on the road towards secularization, but hard to know for sure.
How you mentioned the internet and religions are like shopping and all that. So religions have always recruited, or some religions have always recruited, and I wonder how much of the switching that's going on is because religions are much more active. Most religions are much more actively in the business of recruiting. Like you said, the local fundamentalist church near you is, hey, come on in. We're not about religion. We're about spirituality. I mean, you see that everywhere, right? Yeah. How much of this is religious institutions taking on the nature of brands?
Absolutely. So this, we call this, you can kind of talk about the religious landscape almost like a religious economy. This is, you know, Rodney Stark's work was all about this. He made, you know, he was the pillar of this version. He thought that, yeah, when religion is decentralized, so it's not supported by the government, and the priest and the minister don't get their paycheck from the government, and when you have a diversity of religions out there, what actually happens is it's a situation of competition and you're competing for customers. And so you'll be innovative. You'll offer free Wi-Fi. You'll offer coffee and donuts. You'll offer, you know, quick sermons that aren't boring and beautiful. I mean, you know, you'll market like you have to. And in a way, there's, you know, people act like that's a cynical thing. But like you said, religions have always been in the business. I mean, to be an evangelical meant to share the good news. You know, Christians were charged with, you know, bringing people to Christ. Mormons are like, it's all about like going door to door,
right?
Yeah, door to door sales. Jehovah's Witnesses. In fact, the only religions that aren't strong recruiters tend to be Judaism and Hinduism, which are more civilization rooted traditions and not faith based traditions. You know, when you have a new message, well, you can spread the message of Islam, Buddhism, Christianity. They've always been marketing faiths. There's no question that yes, religions today are out there trying to do their best to get people in. Even the Danish Lutheran churches that are state subsidized have found themselves like, I remember living there and they were offering like spaghetti nights for kids. Like they were racking their brains. What we are finding though is it's not taking. So the marketing isn't working. It's just causing that crisis of credibility for all. And the internet is just a tool. And you would think, well, the internet can be used by religion. But in fact, what all correlations we're seeing is that high internet usage in a population results in decreased religiosity. It doesn't result in, oh, people just finding the religion that suits them, or they're not, this advertisement attracts them. That happens to some people, but more often than not, the internet has not been a friend to religious firms or religious brands or religions in general. And we can, you know, I've already talked about, you know, it creates networks of non-believers. But the other thing is just, there's two other things that it does. It presents people with information they otherwise wouldn't have found. So let's say in the old days, if I was, I saw that, I'm interested in Catholicism. I met a friend who's Catholic. Maybe I ought to check that out. You go to a building with books called a library, and all the Catholic books are going to be in the same section because of the duodecimal system or however it was organized. And you'll just see all these books about, oh, Mary's Assumption. What is that? Here it is. If I Google Mary's Assumption right now, I will immediately be bombarded not only with the Catholic Church's version of it, but critiques of it, debunkings of it. Like, you know, same thing with the Mormons. Like in the old days, if a Mormon came knocking on my door and these white-shirted people seemed like nice young men, I might do a little bit more reading. If I go right now and enter anything about the Mormons, I am going to be onslaughted with criticisms, debunkings, like stuff that you would never have even seen, and you'll go down a rabbit hole. In fact, when people have studied clergy that have lost their faith, so these are people whose lives, they've devoted their lives, these are rabbis, ministers, priests, what was the cause? They often say, well, I had to prepare for a sermon, and I hadn't looked this up since I was in seminary, so I started doing some research on this gospel, and by 3 a.m, I had been exposed to all this biblical criticism, all this debunking, it took them down a rabbit hole, which ended up causing them to lose their faith. And the third thing about the internet is not only does it connect you to other non-believers, which creates community and support, not only does it expose you to criticisms of a religion in a way that would have never happened before, but third, it's just how it functions in our life. The simultaneity, the clicking, the social networking, the porn, the shopping, like it's just made traditional religions seem quaint. Like it can't hold a candle to like the internet, like many things, like reading books, like going to movies. I mean, the internet is replacing like dating. I mean, my kids don't date anymore the way we used to date because they don't even know how to talk to each other because they're always on screens. My kids, when they watch movies, they have a second screen because they find watching a movie too tedious. So they have to be simultaneously texting or playing a video game while watching a movie. It's the same thing's happening in religion. So I don't know what's going to happen.
And one last quick question before we wrap up. Where do you think we go from here? What do you think the future is? Is it more secular nations on the rise? I mean, where what do you think is next at this the rate that we're going?
So what I would say is all indicators have been showing that religion is weakening in terms of belief, behavior, and belonging in most nation national contexts, and has been for the last 100 years. Do I think it's going to continue? Yes and no. The yes is, you know, the driving engine of religion tends to be socialization in the home. In other words, each new generation is taught by the previous generation to be religious. That's how you learn. No 8 or 9 year old has ever been caught, you know, sneaking off to go to church without their parents knowing about it, you know, or, you know, that doesn't, you know, kids are taught religion in the home. Now, as that lessens, you're going to see fewer and fewer people raised with religion, and you're going to see more and more people that that's a normal orientation. And when you're not raised with religion, it's very unlikely you will seek it out as you get an adult. We have data on that. So in that sense, I see increased secularization. On the other hand, as the planet gets hotter, as authoritarianism continues to grow, as life gets more nasty, brutish, and short for more and more people, you will see a need for religion rise. So as dictatorships gain more power, as global capitalists gain more power, as climate change increases, so as the world gets hotter and more precarious, I expect more people to turn to religion. That's the oldest one in the book, and we have data for that too. When society becomes more safe, healthy, educated, when people have their basic needs met, their existentially, like their needs of existence. I don't mean philosophically existential, but I mean like, you know, Maslow's hierarchy of needs. When people have access to food, shelter, there's relative peace and calm, religion tends to plummet. The need for religion tends to plummet. And the opposite happens. When things become precarious, when life is precarious, when, I mean, I expect people, so I see the world becoming more precarious, maybe I'm wrong, but with that, I think you're going to find more people clinging to or searching for comfort, whether that's in the form of nationalism or religion or spirituality or all three. That's so I'm a little bit pessimistic. Well, sorry, I'm secular, so I think people will become more religious. Of course, it depends what kind of religion, and there's good religion and bad religion, and I think more people meditating at a Buddhist monastery sounds good to me, but more people taking up arms for their Lord seems bad to me.
Sounds like a potentially back to the future, but we will see what happens. Dr. Phil Zuckerman, thank you for joining us and giving us these insights. A professor of secular studies and sociology at Pitzer College in Claremont, California, and the co-author of Beyond Doubt, Secularization of Society. Thanks again for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure.
And now the segment you've all been waiting for, the fun fact of the week. And this one is supplied to us from Gallup. In 1949, which one of the three student predictions indicated was before I was born. So yes, that is true. You have to go back to Gettysburg and find out that. But anyway, the question from Gallup in 1949 was, do you think it's too easy in this community to get a driver's license? A driver's license in 1949, 37% said yes, 42% said no, and 21% said they had no opinion, which I think is kind of funny because it's not that complicated a question. So I can only tell you that when I took my driver's test a long time ago, I was under the impression that if you did parallel park and you hit the curb, that was an automatic failure. But so I parallel parked, hit the curb, and still got my license. So I don't know what that was about.
Well, congratulations, Lee. I hope you didn't provide some kind of bribe to get away with that.
No. But I did have a relative once who in New York City asked the driving instructor, you know, whether they had dropped that $20 bill on the seat. That was probably before 1949, however. So the statute of limitations is long gone par.
Well, 1949 was a few years ago. But what's interesting is I did a little bit of research on this. This is still a topic that is often discussed because about 50% of people pass their learner's permit exam on the first try. And there are many people who do think that makes it too easy. So it'd be interesting to find out today. But another question that I had, which I want to ask our student producers here, is how old were you when you got your driver's license? In fact, do you have driver's licenses?
I'll let Tommy go first. I know he got his a little late.
So I only recently got mine this summer just because I was so afraid to do it. And when I did get it, I didn't do well at all. Like, I couldn't even start the car. I was using, like, my BMW, which I never used before.
In Tommy's defense, okay, a BMW is not your normal start and maneuver.
You want to take the test on a car you've practiced on, but
I know. And I wanted to do that, but I was using some Nissan at the driving school. And when I got into the BMW, she was like, do you want to take the test? If you don't know how to start it, you can't do it.
I have been there, Tommy. I have been there.
It's complicated. And I eventually figured it out. And then when I started backing out, I was all over the place. I didn't think I was a pass at all. And then when she got to the end, she was like, okay, let's go get your driver's license. I was like, what?
Wow. Okay.
My only question is, would you also go in and take a final exam for a course you didn't have? Just asking. Seems like a parallel. Yeah.
Also, you said you were afraid. Why? Why were you concerned?
Just the highway. It's kind of scary. You know, high speeds. My mom's always had that problem.
Have you successfully been driving since? Or
I bought a car recently, too. It's a Honda Civic, and I've been using that all the time.
Let me know when you're on the road.
So for me, I am from New Jersey, so I got my permit test in school, and that was when I was 16. And then you had to practice for a year until you can take your test.
Oh, okay.
And the driving instructor was a little wonky. He made me very nervous. He told me I had no perception of the right side of the car and that I would almost hit trash cans. And he told me I had a lead foot. And that freaked me out because I had no idea. So that kind of sparked driving anxiety. So I took the test and it was in the driving instructor's car. And immediately I go to pull away and it just goes beep, 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 because I didn't turn the handbrake off. They didn't even know what a handbrake was. But my driving instructor happened to tell me, like, if you hear beeping, you didn't turn it off. So I stopped the car and I looked terrified. Like, did I just fail before I even started? But he let me keep going and I did pretty good up until the parallel parking, and I guess he thought I was a little too far away from the curb.
Well, they have to get out and walk to the curb. That's usually a bad.
He made me do it again. So he goes, all right, you want to try again? And I'm about to put it in reverse, and then he goes, you know what? Just keep going. And so I got away with whatever I had done wrong. Wow. But
Mean driving tests, getting your license is too easy? It's anxiety producing.
Wait, I still have major driving anxiety. I will not drive if I absolutely don't have to. I've been practicing way more this summer, but only when my mom is in the passenger seat because that's like a safety blanket. But no, I am
very
not a driver.
Look, Neil, okay, save
us. Neil, I think you just drove, you know, halfway across the country. So did you gain this expertise recently, or were you a 16-year-old who couldn't wait to get their permit?
So I got my permit the first month that I turned 16, but it took me a little while to get my license because it was during COVID, so they weren't really testing as much. Yeah. But I actually disagree with Cassidy. I think it's much too hard to get your driver's license because it took me until my third try to pass the test.
Well, right.
And I have some excuses, though. It was COVID, so I couldn't take driver's ed, anything like that. So I was just driving on empty roads, so I wasn't really familiar with traffic. So
that traffic will throw you. I mean, that's really a major problem when you're driving.
Well, the reason why I really wanted to find out when you guys got your license is because this is the trend. You guys are exactly what the trend has been over the last 3-4 decades, particularly younger people wait a while before they get their driver's license, many because they live in places where you can simply get an Uber. And so the need for being able to drive has certainly declined. And I think some of the other things that research has pointed to is just the expense of having a car, which has really increased. It's not like you can work, you know, a summer and afford a car, plus the gas, plus the insurance, and all those wonderful things that come along with that. Yeah. So definitely times have changed. I don't know about when you got your license, Lee, but my parents made me wait a year, even though I could drive a tractor. And I did drive cars on the farm. They did make me wait a year. But then after that, you know, I was good to go. And I actually took my driver's test in a stick shift.
Well, I did too. I did too, because my father thought that if you ever in an emergency, you should know how to do that as well. So I did on a stick shift as well. I would point out that you all have an assignment, and the assignment is that between now and next week, you have to go find a what we used to call an album by Bob Newhart. I don't know if you know who that is, but he was a comedian. He passed away not too long ago, and he did an album in the 1960s. He was a big TV comedian later on in his life. But first he did, he was kind of like a stand-up, and he did a routine on an album called The Button-Down Mind of Bob Newhart. And the episode that he talked about was The Driving Instructor.
Oh, yeah. Go on YouTube.
One tease, the driver is Mrs. Webb, and he's the voice of the driving instructor. And he just says, and the other way to stop? And she said, no, don't put it in reverse. I'll deal with that cheese. Okay, so that is plug for Bob Newhart. It's the button-down line of Bob Newhart, and it's the driving instructor. We'll come back with that next week on the Fun Fact. In the meantime, have a great week, everybody, and be safe on the roads.
That'll do it for Poll Hub this week. Poll Hub is produced by the Marist Poll at Marist University in Poughkeepsie, New York.
Mary Griffith is our executive producer. Casey Schaff is our production supervisor.
The Poll Hub team includes Neil Viswanathan, Enter Petro,
AJ Cambino, Tommy Rogers, and Cassidy Connors.
If you enjoy Poll Hub, please consider leaving a review.
If you'd like to learn more about polling and survey science, check out the Marist Poll Academy, our free online learning portal accessible from our website.
If you have questions for us, tweet them at us at Marist Poll.
Remember, you can always tell your smart speaker to play Poll Hub, and with any luck, it'll cooperate.
Finally, wherever you listen to Poll Hub, there is a subscribe button.
Click it, and the latest episode will be ready for you in your podcasting app as soon as it's released.
We'll see you next time.